for so long, they've been told you're either or, you're on one side of the fence or the other. So then they just kind of subscribe to that concept and go, oh, well, I guess I'm not supposed to have muscles. So therefore I'm not going to go to the gym. If you have been told you're not supposed to think about systems, you're not supposed to get into any kind of detail, then you don't ever work that muscle. And so I think we need to be actually driven by, wow, what's scary, what's hard, what's difficult, what's challenging. Because if I can solve for that, I'm going to become more valuable in the marketplace. Wear that as a badge of honor. It's not comfortable, to be sure, but neither is lifting weight. But if you want the muscles, you got to lift the weight.
What if you could build a business in the modern world as big or as small as you want without having to compromise the things that were the most important to you in the very beginning? This is the Wealthy Consultant Talks podcast with Taylor Welch and Mike Walker, as they share with you today their learning lessons from stories in their experiences over the past 10 to 15 years, and share with you right here, right now. Let's get into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Wealthy Consultant Podcast. If you're listening or watching this, you're probably like, what in the world? That's not the host. Actually, yeah, it's Mike Walker, but today, I am going to be interviewing Mike because Mike, on top of being brilliant in so many different areas, and we don't even have time to go through the accolades and everything that he does for his amazing clients and the Wealthy Consultant, but his book right here, beautiful cover, The Systems Thinking Visionary by Mike Walker himself. It's amazing. I actually got this recently, and Michael even signed it for me. It is so good. But after going through this book, I was like, man, Michael, people need to know the goods that are in this. We got to talk about it more. And so I was like, man, let's interview Mike on his own podcast for
this
once.
This is a switch.
Mike, how you feeling?
I'm good, man. This is fun. You know, it's typically me interviewing others if we have guests. So this is going to be interesting. But you're the best man for the job. So let's dive right in for sure.
Yeah, it's time we put Mike on the pedestal. Let's let Mike give us his wisdom, dude. One of the things I love about this book, and it's one of my favorite things about any book that I would put in my like top 10, would be that the lessons in there. Obviously, it's amazing for who it's really focused towards. But man, I have so many. This highlighter is out. It has been run dry. There's so many lessons in here that apply to so many different areas of life. And I'm excited to get into the nuts and bolts of it and just kind of like pick your brain on some of the items. But I kind of would actually like to start from the beginning if we could, which is like, man, you've got so much value to add. You've done so many great things for so many people in the world. But like, what was going through your mind or your life that made you actually start putting what's in here into the book? Like, where did this come from? Where did this start? Why did you write this book?
Yeah, no, for sure. The catalyst for this book was really two parts. One, it's a distillation of over two decades of personal experience, you know, kind of being the walking the fence of being visionary, but also realizing like, yeah, you can have all the great ideas you want, but that doesn't mean it's actually going to get executed. And so there's that, but then also basically like a mirror, all the clients I work with here at the Wealthy Consultant, and specifically in Chamber, our highest level of consultancy, I'm daily interacting with these same types of people who are phenomenal, extremely brilliant, very successful, and yet they're still dealing with the same challenges that I've had to encounter myself throughout my entrepreneurial journey, which is this gap that seems to exist between the idea, the vision, the grand purpose that you know you have for yourself and your business. But then, yeah, but how do I drill down and get this actually done? And so there's been, in my opinion, a misconception where a lot of visionaries just basically kind of offload the responsibility, or what I call the ownership of that vision, to other people. They're like, oh no, I just live up in the clouds and come up with cool ideas, and then I just give it to everybody else to do. It's like, yeah, okay. I mean, there's such a thing as team and delegation and integrators and all the things, but I think it's been a really big misconception in the business development space for far too long that you are either a visionary or you are an integrator, and visionaries aren't supposed to do anything about the weeds. And I think that is a massive, massive disservice for a large majority of the business owners out there who are just stuck and frustrated because they're like, well, they're not doing it the way I would do it. Exactly. That's the point, is because you're not able to translate the vision into a way that they can truly execute. And so there is absolutely communication. There are, you know, things that you need to get better at in delegation, but a piece of this book is really dedicated to the idea that maybe it's not an either or scenario. Maybe it's a both and visionary and integrator and systems thinking. And that's ultimately what I was wanting to get across, because I felt like I was having this conversation a lot with our fantastic clients. And it's one, again, it's not even their fault, because they've been spoon fed this idea that, oh, you're a visionary, so you just live up in the clouds all day long. And then they're wondering why nothing's actually getting done on the front lines. And so that's ultimately what the aim of this book was.
Dude, powerful. The first time I even heard about something even similar to this idea, I think the it was called like Dreamers and Doers. They're dreamers and they're doers. And that always, I'm resonating with what you're saying, because that always shook me a little bit, where it's like, you can only be one or the other.
Yeah.
Like, you're either trapped over here, you're trapped over there. And I love how you kind of break that that false dichotomy in this book. And it starts out even in chapter one, it started out with bangers. The return on effort in this book is so high from the beginning. You know, some books you read and it's like, I had to read 100,000 pages just to get one big takeaway. And in this one, even chapter one, I already had highlights. Let's dive into that topic at the beginning, like you're saying, where we're taught that's like, you're only one or the other, but the best of the best, they're both, and you can be both. You know, when you're talking about how, like, yes, vision is important, execution is just as important. Your brilliant ideas are worthless if you can't speak the language of execution. Amazing. Talk to us a little bit more about this idea. And then I'm curious too, why do you think so many people struggle, whether they feel like they maybe lean more on the side of the visionary and they feel like they can't get into the execution, or maybe vice versa? Where do you think that struggle comes from?
Yeah, ultimately, I think because, again, for so long, they've been told you're either or, you're on one side of the fence or the other. So then they just kind of subscribe to that concept and go, oh, well, I guess I'm not supposed to have muscles, so therefore I'm not going to go to the gym. And guess what? When you don't go to the gym, you don't have muscles and you're weak. And so it's the same concept here. It's like, if you have been told you're not supposed to think about systems, you're not supposed to get into any kind of detail, then you don't ever work that muscle. And so it feels hard naturally. And to be sure, and I even say this in the book, like, look, I'm not trying to turn visionaries into integrators. Without question, there are people that are more lean towards the detail and that they actually like that minutia. And there's people who are like, oh my God, it makes my eyes want to glaze over when I think about it. I get that. But you can't just check out and just go, oh, well, because this is hard, I'm therefore going to just give it all away to someone else and then be frustrated by the fact that your vision isn't coming to fruition. So that's where I'm ultimately trying to get to, is like, look, even if you're not going to be the one that lives and breathes the details all day long, you need to be able to speak the language so that when you're delegating and when you're offloading some of that authority and decision-making to somebody else, you are speaking their language and there's a shared understanding of what success even looks like. And that ultimately is the challenge that I think a lot of quote unquote visionaries have, is they have these ideas, but they don't know how to articulate it in a way that actually gets implemented in real life.
Dude, 100%. I heard, I can't remember what book it's from, so this is a failure on my part as the host of this conversation right now. But I remember reading somewhere a while back, someone was talking about, with entrepreneurs, the art of execution is so undervalued. And he was saying that sometimes execution, if done really, really well, can sometimes even make the idea almost obsolete. Like, whether it's a great idea or it's a subpar idea, if you can execute at an excellent level, it will almost amplify the quality of the idea itself. Yes. What do you think about that in terms of, like, do you feel like one is more important than the other? Do you feel like one is more underrated or underutilized than the other? Just out of curiosity.
It's quantum, man. It's like the true quantum entanglement. You can't have black without white. You can't have night before the day, right? You need both to have the contrast. That's the contrast is where the brilliance lives. But I think what happens is that if you can truly bring your ideas to your team and to those that are going to be responsible on a day in, day out basis to understand the systems and the processes involved, the mechanics, if you can truly bring the vision to them in a way that they can understand it thoroughly, and articulate it back to you. There's a little secret. Mm. Can your team articulate back to you in their own words what the vision is, what success looks like for them? That's a really interesting question to ask anybody on your team. What's success look like in your role? What's success look like in your division? And then just zip up and listen and see if it comes back the way that you would want it or not. It's a simple thing to do, but very few people will actually implement that simple question. But all that to say that if you can have the team articulate and sync with your vision in their own terms, in their own language, ultimately, like what you were just saying, you'll be surprised. You'll be like, wow, like I thought it was going to be this, but man, they took it to a whole nother level. I didn't even know that we could do such and such. And that's the brilliance of true visionary leadership, is not being the one that's always needed, but being the one that can set the trajectory, but then let your team dictate how far can you actually go when they bring their brilliance to the game table. And all of a sudden your vision just got way better. And that takes trust, takes time to develop that. But ultimately, when done well, it'll be a force magnifier on your original vision, to be sure.
You talk about being able to have your team be able to repeat it back to you. And I highlighted this. I think this is from chapter three. So I'm hopping back and forth a little bit, but since you bring it up, this section right here says, an important side note for all of you experts out there: when communicating your ideas to others, it's easy to forget what it's like to not know what you know. When we're passionate about a topic and spend every waking hour immersed in our world, we have to be mindful to not assume that what seems entirely basic and obvious to us is the same for others. Mm-hmm. By the way, brilliantly written. I feel like that connected dots even for me from the sales perspective almost too, which again, it's just so applicable to so many other areas of life and other areas of business. But how often do you see with all the clients in chamber, launch kit, stuff like that you work with, where this is actually one of the big hangups when we get to that place to start building team, adding on team members, where we maybe have the vision, we have a little bit of the execution in there too, but we're trying to get others on the vision, them not just understand the cool and desired result, but they can actually see it. They drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak. Is that a tough hurdle that you've seen a lot of people have to go get over?
Absolutely. You know, this really hits home in two key areas. One, I say it all the time, that frustration is simply the gap between expectation and reality. Frustration is the gap between expectation and reality. So the farther away those two things are, the more frustrated you feel. So if you're expecting to be this, but it's actually this, now you're frustrated. But if you can align those things more and go, hey, look, I expect it to be this, but reality, like real life scenario, it's actually more like this. Now that's not even to suggest that you even like it. It's just that you're accepting it. You go, yeah, that's just kind of how it goes here. It's going to be tough. Now I'm not frustrated anymore. So even if we're not talking the same language, I'm like, yeah, but that's how that works. So just removing, like downgrading the frustration level will increase the quality of communication you have as you try to like figure out, how do I communicate this effectively? Hey guys, I don't know if I'm saying this right. Here's my idea, but I need you to hit me back with questions. You explain it back to me. Did I get my point across? Like, work through it. Don't just be frustrated. I gave them the vision. I gave them the one pager on it. I sent them the video and they're still not doing it. I'm so pissed right now. It's like, dude, yeah, that's the thing. That's the communication gap that we're having. So it really hits home there. But also I think where this whole communication gap hits home too is the fact that, like, as people are trying to express their vision and what good looks like in their world, they don't necessarily value their own vision. And here's the key part. So many subject matter experts forget what it's like to not know what they know. And so they're like, well, no one would really care about this. Like, everybody knows how to do that. And you're like, dude, no. Like, it's basic to you, but you're blowing my mind over here. And so they actually undervalue, they underscore what they know and the importance of bringing their vision to life, because they count it as basic, as no one would really care about that. It's not that big of a deal. I've known this for 10 years. Yeah, you have, but there's an entire world of people here that don't know how to tie their shoes. So it may be very basic to you to tie your shoes, but there, you could literally write a book and change someone's life from tripping all over themselves for their entire future, if you just teach them what to you is very basic. but to them, it's life changing. And so I think a lot of subject matter experts forget that, and therefore they undervalue and just think of all the amazing IP that has not been brought to the world because they didn't think it was that big of a deal.
Dude, yeah, like they feel like, oh, if I might be preaching to the choir, I'm beating a dead horse. This is obvious. And then it's like, no, there's a huge gap between your understanding of the vision and theirs, right? Incredible. You also put in here the being the owner of a dream does not by default grant license or the ability to bring it to fruition. That speaks to me of like entitlement, that like I have this big vision, this big idea, I must be entitled to it because I came up with it. And that's just not the case, which is why you hit execution as well hard in chapter one, right? Would you classify yourself as more of the visionary or the execution side of it? What do you think?
I think by default, my natural strengths are deconstructing very complex things and breaking them down into systems. I think my brain is very right, you know, leans that
spreadsheets,
systems. I could geek out on that, right? But as I've become more experienced as an entrepreneur and as I've had to grow through the different iterations of quote unquote success, whatever you deem that to be, I've realized that, wow, it's hard to be a leader though if I'm head down just looking at spreadsheets all day. Like I actually need to communicate the vision. I need to tell us where are we going though. And so I've actually had to kind of come the other way of to flex my muscle of the visionary, flex my muscle of communication, and be okay with the idea of delegating out some of these things that honestly I'd be fine to do. Like, give me the spreadsheet, give me the mirror board. Like I'll geek out on you all day long with funnels and all the fun stuff. And yet, but if I'm down there doing those things down into the fundamentals, I can't necessarily help us trajectory wise as an organization. And so I've had to actually flex the other way. And over, I'd say the last 5 years in particular, I feel like I've really started to feel more confident in the visionary piece of my brain. And that's why I wanted to connect the dots here. It's like, hey, I know what it's like to get it done, but now I need to figure out how do I communicate this effectively at the visionary level to make sure that we can bring both sides of the brain together.
I love it. Amazing. Let's talk about chapter four. Personally, this was one of my favorite chapters in the book, Conquering Overwhelm and Mastering Focus. And in this chapter, we label the enemy. Mm. The enemy is what?
Content overwhelm, data by data, like you name it. You know, there's static noise. It goes on and on.
Everything that can add to that overwhelm, which actually pulls away the focus and the productivity. You said here, the world doesn't need more busy entrepreneurs. It needs visionary leaders who can think big, see far, and guide their teams towards audacious goals. Talk to us a little bit more about that, like the risk of overwhelm. Tell us a little bit more about that. This chapter is amazing. And by the way, everyone listening to this, you're only getting a smidgen from Mike on this. You got to read the book. This chapter is amazing. But talk to us a little bit more about that overwhelm enemy.
Yeah, overwhelm is, it's massive, right? Because as soon as you start to feel overwhelmed, what happens? Oh, you just almost stop, right? It's like you're halfway through a marathon. And you're like, okay, I'm not going to make this. Like, and immediately you just get worse. You just start spiraling down and down and down because you just, your belief level, the faith level starts to erode away at the reality of the weight that you're under. And, you know, I think it's Steve Jobs that says success is a lot more to do with what you say no to than what you say yes to. Mm. And that's something that I really had to work really, really hard on growing up earlier on in my entrepreneurial path, was coming out of the mind of scarcity. You know, we grew up with not a lot of money. And so I had this idea and I had this kind of concept of, I'm going to go and just wherever I can get, you know, an opportunity, I'm going to grab it. And basically saying yes to everything. Oh, I can be good at that. Great. Oh, there's an opportunity to take it. And what's happening is at first that can be good. Actually, I even tell like early stage entrepreneurs, hey, just say yes to everything because you don't know what you're naturally going to be good at. You don't know what you're actually going to be like tuned to for. So I say, just say yes to everything. You'll very quickly realize what you like and what you don't like. So that's how you start. But to truly get to the next level, like what got you to stage one is not going to be the same methodologies that get you to stage two. And so I think the more advanced you become and the more, you know, the larger of the organization you create, the better you have to get at saying no, even to really good ideas.
Yeah.
Even 100%. To really good ideas. That's the hard part. It's like, dude, we could crush it with this. We could make so much money with this. You're right. and you still have to say, but I'm not going to do it. And that's really, really hard, but it's so good. It's such a good opportunity. That'd be stupid to say no. I know, but we got to stay true. We got to maintain momentum, 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 momentum. I tell our clients all the time, like in real estate, what do you say? Location, location, location.
Yeah.
Business, momentum, momentum, momentum. It's so hard to generate that once you have it, you have to maintain it and do not distribute your attention, time, effort, energy, and money across too many other initiatives. You've got to like remain focused. And the word focus gets so overused. People like glaze over. Like, yeah, I know I stay focused, but it's hard. Like it is the number one enemy of our age. I believe if attention is the new oil, then focus is the new like platinum or, you know, diamond. It is so hard to remain focused when you are being bombarded by information, data overwhelm, noise, you know, all the things. So I think the ability for a leader, an entrepreneur, a visionary to identify really awesome ideas and still say no, I think is a superpower that far too many underscore and don't simply optimize for.
It sounds like that mindset of like in the beginning, saying yes to everything, how that could be a good thing, but good things can also turn into bad things down there. Like it's got a diminishing rate of return. You also talk about how busyness doesn't equal productivity. Mm-hmm. And so how like in the beginning saying yes to everything might be really good, but then we reach this threshold where it's got the diminishing rate of return, but we haven't rewired the decision-making process of like, okay, now it might be appropriate to start saying no to certain things. Is that right?
Nailed it. And ironically, we actually had a conversation on our chamber call. We have a call every week with chamber members on Wednesdays. And, you know, one of them came on and said, hey, how do you know when this is just a shiny object issue and I'm just being allured to something that could be cool? Or it's like, no, this is a pivot. This is something that I'm supposed to take action on. And I ran through a series of different like protocols, if you will, that I have. But one of the big ones that I think can help people immediately is what I call delegating pillars in your decision-making processes, things that are, become like monuments of truth and they never change. I'll give you one of mine, just as an example, because again, the entrepreneurial brain, the visionary brain in particular, is like a magnet for ideas, a magnet for opportunity. That's their brilliance. That's what they're so good at, but it's also their Achilles heel because they're constantly seeing, being exposed to all these really cool ideas. Well, good for you. But if you just keep chasing them, you're all over the map. You're never generating momentum. And so a pillar of truth that I've kind of created for myself was the question, okay, this, I've been presented with a really good opportunity, maybe a new business venture or whatnot, or a partnership or who knows what. Okay. Can I operate this new opportunity remotely with a laptop and a Wi-Fi? If not, I'm not doing it. So just there alone, that's a massive filter. It could be a new building. It could be a new organization that I'd have to be, you know, there 12 hours a day or whatever. I don't care. I don't care how much money, how successful it is. I'm not doing it. Just not. I really love autonomy. I love to travel. We want to move around with the family. Like that's not going to be a reality. And so it allows me very quickly, no matter how good it is, no matter how shiny it is, I can immediately cut down the cognitive load that is required for decision-making by simply having these pillars of truth, if you will. And that's just one example, but I think it gets easier to say no to really good ideas when you have these pre-built in your mind. So when you are presented with very weighty conversations and decision-making, then you can filter through those much faster without feeling like analysis paralysis and overwhelmed.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I think sometimes like I feel this when I was reading this, I was checking myself a little bit because there's plenty of times where, and everyone who listens to this is going to resonate, where I feel busy. I feel so busy. I feel overwhelmed. But then I look at my day and I'm like, I didn't get anything done. Mm-hmm. Why do I feel so busy? Well, I was doing a lot of things and whatnot. I read this recently in a book too. It said the day you decide not to question what you believe is the day you start making excuses for why you believe it. And I think I had caught myself just believing that I had to do this. I have to do this. I'm supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And so I would just do them and I would justify that because it's just what I believe. And I think this was actually really good and eye-opening for me where I was like, hold on, let me actually question, why do I think I have to be the one to do this? Mm-hmm. That can be almost sometimes be a difficult conversation, especially for entrepreneurs, like a lot of the clients that we work with where they're like, well, I don't have time because I have to do X, Y, and Z. And you're the one to ask them like, why do you have to do it? Well, I don't know. You should think about that, right? Did you catch yourself having to ask yourself those questions? Was that difficult? Or do you still feel overwhelmed quite a bit too? Or, you know, the mental models, the templates you just talked about, has that helped a lot?
Yeah, no, it's helped a lot. It's definitely a dragon I've had to slay, but I feel very confident that I've been able to slay it. There's a process that I walk clients through all the time. And I think we can do it here in a brief order version, is that whenever someone feels like, oh, I'm so overwhelmed, I don't know what to do, I've got so much on my plate, I go, whoa. Like, whatever decision you come up with right now is not going to be that great. Quality of thinking begets the quality of output, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. not going to work. And so what I typically walk clients through who are in that stage of overwhelm is I say, first, you're going to take, about 30 minutes minimum, no distractions, no screens, no notifications, just you, a pen and a pad of paper, and you're just going to brain dump. You're going to get every single thing out of your brain. Doesn't matter what it is, doesn't matter in what order, what category, it doesn't matter. You're just literally going to download every single thing that is bouncing between your ears, write it, scratch it out on paper really quick. Once that's done, you feel like I've literally like emptied my brain on this piece of paper. You have now take, you know, from the ether of thought and you distilled it into its physical form on paper. You now own that busyness in your brain on something that you're physically holding with your hands on paper. So then walk away, go take a nap, a long walk, come back with fresh eyes, typically 24 hours later, and then start to run a highlighter across every single thing that actually matters or that should actually like benefit or justify your attention to it. You'll typically find, if you're asking yourself the right questions, that there's not a whole lot of those. There might be a lot, but shouldn't be overwhelming. The whole page should not be yellow, to be sure. And then you start to segment that, go, okay, well, what can I act on now? What can I act on later? Should I do this late, you know, today? Should this happen next year? Whatever. And what happens is now that overwhelm that you're feeling has been brought down to something that you're physically in control of with your hand and with your pen. So that alone creates ownership. It creates a sense of I own this and not it's owning me. And then therefore you start to go, oh, okay, cool. So all this clutter that's been in between my ears now exists just on this piece of paper. I own this. I have control over it. I'm only going to act on 1, 2, 3 things right now. Everything else can stick away. And just being able to remove it out of your head is a really powerful way to do it. And it's gotten me through a lot of rough times, just that one simple practice.
I own this. This isn't owning me. Yep. Powerful, man. I can't imagine how many people resonate with that. And they're like, I wish I felt that way. That gives us a good segue when we're talking about questions. Let's talk about quantum decision-making. This chapter was packed full of amazing topics. Talk to us a little bit about quantum decision-making.
Yeah. So it sounds lofty, right? But it's actually a fairly straightforward concept once you've gone through it once or twice. And we provide literally a downloadable PDF that you can get in the book that will walk you through this process. So we won't go through it linearly now. But the general premise of this is that a lot of visionaries in particular have this idea, but this applies across lives, across different, you know, scenarios. People have this idea that it's either you call it the crossroads moment, right? Or I'm at this decision-making crossroads. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that immediately kind of symbolizes a, do I go left or do I go right?
Yeah.
It's A or B. It's good or bad. It's right or it's wrong. But life isn't like that. It's very few times in life where it's truly binary. And so this framework that we created for this book specifically is something that I've used for years now, but I never really quantified it into a system or into a format or template that you can use. But basically what it does is it walks you through the process of thinking about the fact that, well, hang on, there's actually other realities, other decision points that you have never even considered. And so it prompts you through questions. What if it wasn't A or B? What if it was C or D? And you think, well, that's ludicrous. Like that's not even in the realm of reality. Fine. Yeah. But what if? And what happens is you immediately break the glass ceiling of it being a binary thing. And all of a sudden you start realizing, well, hang on, that might be a little lofty. Like A, B, I can understand. C and D is a little like, a little out there, a little bit of a stretch. But what if? What are the second and third order consequences of that? What is the waterfall effect? If that was a reality, if I did actually pursue that, what are some of the other things? And now what you start finding is that there are pieces of that what at first seemed like a ridiculous or way outside the box answer or you know, decision. Now all of a sudden you start picking at it and you realize, wait a second, there are elements of this that I could actually use right now that aren't so crazy. This is actually pretty doable. It's pretty paradigm shifting, honestly. And yeah, you have to understand that this isn't just some woo-woo thing of like, oh, quantum thinking. It's literally physics, like quantum physics. So yeah, we can understand that our decisions literally have a frequency to them. And when you start putting out into the universe these types of thoughts, and more specifically the words that you use, the frequencies and the vibrations that come from that is literal science. And you go pretty deep down that rabbit hole. But the reality is that you can just understand that the reality is you're probably not at a crossroads. You're at a field of options. You're in this field of opportunities that if you just were to explore what these other areas could look like, the quality of your decision-making will improve, and the confidence, and this is the big word that I'll wrap up on, it's the confidence in that decision-making that really, because you have thought so far beyond A and B or right or wrong or left or right. You're like, no, I've looked at that, but I've played 3 or 4 dimensional chess on this thing. I'm no longer just playing checkers. I'm thinking in multiple levels, multiple orders of consequence, farther down the road. And the confidence that is derived from that layer of thinking is really what will separate true visionaries from people that are just kind of dreaming and crossing their fingers along the way.
Dude, so good. You just mentioned even the confidence of decision making. And one of my favorite sections in this chapter was about the fear of making wrong choices, because all of us have made the wrong choices before and we've all been filled with regret. And that feeling is so palpable and it's so real. And we never forget how it feels, that now we start becoming so afraid of experiencing that again, that we're afraid to make decisions in general. And I love how you walk people through in this book about like not being afraid of making choices. There's some amazing good quotes in here around like, you shouldn't be afraid of even making the wrong choice, but of like making no choice. Because would you qualify that as a decision fatigue or a analysis by paralysis?
Yeah, definitely. It's all of that, you know, and things that I think a lot of people have heard of. But one step further, I think it's understanding that two things, actually. One, it's decision velocity. Some of the most successful people that I've ever had the opportunity to work with, be mentored by, or to even mentor them even, has their decision velocity was so fast. I was like, whoa, that's you decided that quick, huh? And they're like, yep. It's like, okay, but what if you're wrong? Well, we'll figure it out. Oh, okay. And as I became more and more mature of an entrepreneur, I started realizing, yeah, you know what? It's far better to go left and be wrong than it is to sit at the crossroads and wonder. And I started realizing, man, how much farther would I be if I had just gone the wrong direction, hit the wrong wall first and go, yep, that was wrong. Great. 180 it back to the other direction. I would have come to the right conclusion faster had I made the wrong decision faster. And so that it was just like, man, I wish I'd known this a long time ago. I would be probably a lot farther along than overanalyzing and being scared to go the wrong way or think that, you know, I should know all the answers. And the reality is most of the time you won't. If you're truly visionary, if you're truly doing something impactful in the world that's either never been done or needs to be done on a whole new level, then the reality is that you're going to need to fail forward faster. And I think a lot of people get scared of that word fail. And so I like to spin that up is like, what did we learn?
Yeah.
You didn't fail. You just learned something. So what did you learn from it? It's only failure if you screw up, fall down, don't get up, and don't learn from it. That's the failure. That's the ultimate failure. But if you fall down and go, oh, yep, okay, supposed to use your feet, not your hands to walk. Got it. Next, boom. That is not even close to a failure anymore. That is a lesson learned that you will never have to repeat again. Hyper valuable to your lifelong journey, you know?
I think that might've been probably the most powerful thing that we've touched on so far in this conversation. So everyone listening, I think you should rewind, listen to that again. Talk to us a little bit more about what is decision velocity for anyone that hasn't read the book yet. And they're like, what the hell is that? Well, talk to us a little bit about that. What does that mean to you? Decision velocity.
In simple terms, it's just understanding that when you are confronted with a decision, yes, you want to consider the data. Yes, you want to consider, you know, the ramifications, Very few, this is the key takeaway for decision velocity. Very few people understand this. A lot of your decisions are not irreversible. There's very few decisions that you will make in life or in business that are not irreversible. So when you are confronted with a impactful or potentially, you know, very, you know, a big deal decision, you need to ask yourself first, is this reversible? If I go left and I'm supposed to go right, is this something that I can quickly, you know, reverse course on? Yes. Great. Then move quickly because it's not irreversible. And yeah, you might, you know, skin your knee along the way. You might drop some money on the ground along the way, but ultimately you're not going to die and you're not going to take anybody else out with you. Great. Move fast. But if you are confronted with a decision or something that's very, you know, going to impact the trajectory of your entire life and the generations thereafter, then naturally you're going to want to tread a little bit lighter and really like slow down and again, control the decision-making process by going, no, because of the weight of this decision, I am going to take the time. I'm going to do whatever I need to do to feel like I've truly weighed out the different scenarios through quantum decision-making process and that type of thing. But honestly, like there's just not that many of those types of questions that, and if you just move faster, regardless of whether you end up in the right position or not, you will be able to just find the right path because you're moving so much faster than all of your competition around you.
Yeah. And I think too, it's important to mention, like, by the way, I love that very few decisions in life are irreversible. I think it's so easy for me to convince myself that this isn't reversible, but like the definition of reversible, it doesn't mean that I hit the rewind button. I go back in time. I never made the decision. It just means I'm not trapped there.
Yep. Exactly.
It's like, you're literally not trapped. You made a mistake. That doesn't mean that you can't fix it, make a better decision, move on from there. Would you agree that feeling of being trapped, that we trick ourselves into thinking that this decision is irreversible, we can never fix it from here? Do you think that's one of the big things that causes people to not choose left or right?
I think it is fear, but ultimately I think it's ego. People don't like to be wrong. They don't like to admit that they moved forward and they didn't know the answer. And so you just have a lot of people going like, I don't know. Like they love to talk about the 10-year goal, the 5-year goal. But as soon as you drill down to, but what's good look like 30 days from now? How are we going to get there? Oh, I don't know. You know why they don't know? Because they don't want to subscribe themselves to the responsibility of ownership required to actually get it done. That's the problem.
Dude, this is so good. You also give a lot of, I'm not going to go through them right now because I want people to actually get the book, but you even give out a lot of different questions on the power of better questions in the same quantum decision-making, because someone might be listening to this and they're like, okay, cool. What are those? How do I actually, I've never asked myself these questions. You have the whole list of them right here and some even example questions to consider. I won't go into those because I want people to actually read these themselves. But I love how you even just, you give the template and the stencils, like here's something to go ahead and get you started.
Yep.
You know, that's at the very end of the chapter. So good. So good. Let's go to chapter 9, the purpose profit flywheel. The greatest threat to your vision isn't opposition. It's optimization of the wrong things.
Yeah.
Did you come up with that yourself?
I did, man. I did.
Dirty dog. So tell us more about that. How often do you see that with our clients in chamber?
That actually spurred that statement or quote, whatever you want to call it, spurred from my own processes and realizing that
really,
I've spent so much time optimizing the wrong thing, you know, and like trying to focus on the 1% mover or the 2% needle movers, when in actuality, if I had zoomed out a little bit, I'd realize that, can I make this better? Yes. But is it ultimately going to feed the true purpose? And I think when you can zoom out as a visionary and understand that you want to be purpose led, and yet a lot of people think that chasing their purpose, like their God-given purpose, can't be profitable at the same time. This comes from a lot of different angles. A lot of people struggle with the idea of like, well, I want to do what I love. Well, yeah, that all sounds real nice. But the reality is there's gonna be a lot of things that you don't like doing along the way, right? Like I love, you know, building empires, helping other people build their empires, but there's a lot of stuff along the way that I don't like to do. That's the reality. Yeah. So this whole adage of like, oh, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. Honestly, that's bullshit. Like there's a lot of days that are not fun for me, but the days may not be fun, but the year was amazing because it was truly purpose built. It was towards a path or an ultimate goal that does serve my ultimate purpose, what I deem to be my purpose, right? So I think that's kind of the big takeaway in that chapter alone, is just understanding that it's not a either or thing. If you can figure out how to connect your God-given purpose, why you're on this planet, with a profitable mechanism, that's a game changer, because no one can do great things if they're just broke and struggling all the time. That's like chaining weights around your ankles and expecting you to run a marathon. You're just not going to be able to do it very well. So I think a lot of people have this conflict within them that if I'm doing truly something aspirational or purpose-driven, that it can't be about the money too. And I just think money is a fuel. And if you can figure out how to fuel your vision and your purpose, you're therefore going to get much farther along. So that's the concept of that whole purpose profit flywheel.
What it kind of reminded me of the first time I read it was about the Truett Cathy's big quote about Chick-fil-A. And he said, if we get better, our customers will demand we get bigger. And I think that's even an example of what I was pulling from this section, was that like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. And how you, like you said, it's not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can have both. Do you feel like that requires, though, someone to be able to overcome that fear of making decisions, to be able to see that we can have both? We don't just have to choose one or the other and then live in the bed we make.
Yeah, 100%. It's all connective, to be sure. It's kind of like a matrix, right? They all, every decision or every paradigm that you filter information through is going to have a shockwave effect across the others, and will therefore present another series of questions. Like, ultimately, I say this to our clients all the time, like, the business of business is relationships, and the business of business is solving problems. So every day you should wake up and go, what problem am I solving today? Like, it's so funny that I see entrepreneurs that will come to calls, or they'll, you know, when they first come into our ecosystem, and they're kind of wide-eyed and surprised that life, quote unquote, life is slapping them around, or that their business is hard. And it's like, yeah, that's what this is. It's every day you're solving a new problem. The higher quality problems you solve, the more money you can demand in the marketplace. And so I think we need to be actually driven by, wow, what's scary, what's hard, what's difficult, what's challenging. Because if I can solve for that, I'm going to become more valuable in the marketplace, more deserving of the economic exchange that will come by being and solving more larger problems. And so wear that as a badge of honor. It's not comfortable, to be sure, but neither is lifting weight. But if you want the muscles, you got to lift the weight.
Come on, man. You got to lift the weight. One of my other favorite quotes from yours, and I just had this imagery with it. It says, your vision is not a destination, it's a compass. Let it guide you, but be prepared to forge new paths. In my mind, I had this imagery of someone going on a hike, and they're so focused on only looking at the compass that you miss the view, the beautiful view of like where you're walking through or whatever. And then the other side of that is like, well, I'm just not going to look at it all. I'm only going to experience the view. And then you get lost.
Yeah.
And we never find where we're going, where we're supposed to be. I thought that was really powerful. And for whatever reason, that stood out to me. And I think that was one of your favorite quotes too. Is there another favorite part of this book that we didn't get to hit that you just feel you love talking about, and you're like, man, more people need more of this?
Yeah, there is a piece. One of the tools, there's a lot of tools like downloadable assets that come with,
yes,
you just go to the website and you get them for free. So it's just,
what's the website? Let the people give them what they want. What's the website?
Yeah. So the best way to get the book is to go to Amazon, just search The Systems Thinking Visionary. It'll pop right up. So get the book there. And then within the book is actually a QR code that you can scan, and it'll get you access to these tools.
Perfect.
So that's the best way. Just search on Amazon, The Systems Thinking Visionary, will pop right up. But one of the tools that has, without question, changed lives over the last 15 years of consulting that I've been doing specifically with clients in this type of space is the color code system. The color code system is an extremely simple way, a process of delegating your day and breaking up your time blocks and allocating your time to the most meaningful things. Like you said earlier about how, like, man, I've been busy all day, but I didn't really do anything.
Yeah.
And so this color code system helps break that down and help you identify what I call MMAs, money-making activities. Not to say that money is the ultimate, but in the instance of business, you kind of want to make sure you're, you know, yeah, profitable. But MMAs could be, you know, most meaningful activities, right? And it could be, yeah, like whatever it means the most to you. But when you see things, our brains are really good at looking at color and identifying variants of the color very, very quickly. That's what our eyes were designed for. What our eyes were not designed for is to look at a 25 item to-do list and immediately identify what's good, what's bad, what should have been delegated out, what should have just been deleted, right? It's just a lot of detail. So you're looking at this long thing and equating that to look at all the value that is, confusing the length for value. That's not the reality. The value is actually the one or two things within that data set that were the MMAs. And if you can very quickly identify the MMAs amongst all the activity, it really helps you delegate more effectively. It helps you eliminate more effectively. And you just become a better visionary because you get to spend more time on the truly needle moving things in your life and business. And so that one tool, it's very, very simple. We walk you through the whole process, but it's a game changer when it comes to that color code system.
It sounds like that would also help with increasing the decision velocity as well.
Totally.
Because if you have this whole list, my mind does not automatically just start reorganizing them in terms of like which is most important or which are the key ones. But if we have a tool, a template that can be able to spread that out for us, then I feel like that would even remove some of the decision fatigue and increase the decision velocity.
It totally does. Quality of thinking. I mean, ultimately, all of this comes down to the quality of thinking. Quantum thinking, it's quality. It's not binary. It's not A or B, left or right, right or wrong. It's an entire matrix of opportunity. And it's our ability as visionaries, as builders, to identify the multiple different opportunities, the multiple different ways we could go about something, and bring that into a very step-by-step, clear process from point A to point B. And when you can do that, now you're truly a visionary worth following because you're not just a dreamer, you're actually a builder. And that's ultimately the purpose of the book.
Dude, amazing. I love it. Guys, you heard it first from the master himself, system thinking visionary. Get it on Amazon, go through the workbooks, go through the exercises. Amazing. Mike, you are brilliant. This is extremely well written. And I think it's going to help a ton of people, help me a lot as well. So thank you for putting in the effort and creating the vision and writing it out in a way that the simple masses like myself can get a lot from it. So you're amazing. Thank you so much.
No, this is awesome, man. This was fun. And thanks for everybody joining us. This was a cool spin on things. So thanks for your time, Peyton. Appreciate you, bro.
Absolutely.